We've all heard the phrase, that kind of thing doesn't happen in our town. But here on Midwest Murder, we will shatter that false reality. In fact, it happens more often than we know, and sometimes the details of the most horrific crimes that happen in our neighborhoods are lost in the back pages of newspapers, forgotten on our news channels, and eventually erased over time. We're here to talk about murder, diving into some of the most controversial cases in Midwest history. The show will not shy away from the morbid details of these horrific events and the often ugly truths behind them. What you will hear is a detailed timeline of events, perspectives from those closely involved, and analysis by experts. What you will feel is the darkness that surrounds each story, the innocence lost by the victims, and hopefully the justice that was ultimately delivered.
Ooh, Don Palumbo.
Jonah Lanto.
Or tonight, should I call you Don Double Fisting Palumbo? It's actually her nickname in the business.
No.
I don't know if you guys knew that or not. That's what we call her.
No, dear God, do not. And they're going to have to edit that out of TV, too. Like, that feels, that got weird. Yeah. You gotta like, figure that out. Like, yeah.
I'm a nicknamer of people.
He is.
So.
All right. So, a huge thank you to those of you listening. But, and of course, to those of you joining us tonight at the Bell in Bismarck. It is a record-setting crowd for us. And I have to correct Terry. There were actually 50 people
at our first show. Yeah.
So
not 35.
Yeah. And okay. He had to restrain me because I was like poking my head out. And I was like, it was 50. It was not 35. It was 50.
Those 15 people matter. We don't do math here. Okay, this is Midwest Murder,
but
not Midwest Math.
We know it was 50 people.
But we know it was 50.
Yeah, exactly. So, but you know, it's huge, and it has been an incredible journey along the way. And with this weirdo beside me, it's really cool. And so to have you guys in this journey with us is absolutely incredible. So a big thank you to all of you. I gotta quit getting mushy. I don't like it. But
getting mushy and squishy.
And of course. God, you're being weird. And of course, a huge, huge thank you to those who have rated and reviewed the podcast. We're so grateful for the comments. The comments and the ratings do huge things for us. And when Terry mentioned that we're trending, you know, and sometimes in the top 60, that's because of you guys, you know. So huge, huge thank you. We really, really do appreciate it. So Jonah, what are people saying about Midwest Murder?
Yeah, we appreciate the reviews, guys. You can review us on iTunes, Facebook, Audible. This one comes from SD Farm Mama. Literally love this podcast. 5 stars. I really want to write something witty and funny so I can be on a shirt, but unfortunately, I'm intellectually lazy. Sounds like someone I know. Not going to name any names here.
That'd be me.
All jokes aside, I love this podcast. I grew up in Minnesota, now live in South Dakota, so I will always be a Midwest girl. I love the beginning of the episodes and recap of the happenings in that time frame. Also, the live shows are so much fun. Big fan. I quote, literally tell everyone about you guys. You better be out there telling someone about us right now. wherever you are. This next one comes from Jazz 91121. Good. It's 4 stars. Good, but maybe less joking. I've been enjoying this podcast a lot, but the longer I've listened, the more inappropriate jokes Jonah has made throughout his cases and Don's. That's why I couldn't give this a 5-star rating, because these are terrible things that have happened and his jokes feel wrong and rude. Sad face.
Maybe because yours aren't very funny.
Oh,
I'm just kidding.
Is that why you loaded that one in there for me to read so you could make that joke?
No, the reason I loaded this one in there is because, you know, yes, we do make jokes, but it is never, ever, ever about the victim or their families. That is my dark humor. That's just how I get through things sometimes. And if you have been in law enforcement, or if you're a nurse, if you're a doctor, if you're an EMT, whatever, you get it. Absolutely. And that's, for me, that's how I cope. And, you know, also trying to remember that is difficult for people to hear sometimes. So
Yeah, we of course never make jokes at the expense of the victims, and I think it's important to cut heavy emotions with a little bit of levity when you can, and I think sometimes it's necessary. And these are the organic, natural reactions of sometimes our dark, I wouldn't say morbid, but dark humor.
No, I would say morbid and for me, for sure.
That's the way it goes. We appreciate the review. I'm going to have to keep doing me. What you're getting.
And it never comes from a place of disrespect.
No.
Just ever. And I would be the first one to beat him up if it did. So.
Yeah, she'd call me out on that for sure.
You're shitting right, I would. And I would call you out. I would call you out in front of people too. So, I've done that a few times. Who heard the Sioux Falls episode and heard me call Jonah out about the Anastasia? Did you guys hear that? Yeah. Poor guy. I called him out on that, so I do feel kind of bad.
Some people live for those call-outs. Some of those listeners out there, they're pretty stoked about those call-outs. Yeah.
Anyway, thank you to those who rate and review. Again, it's regardless of whether they are good, bad, ugly, whatever, we do take them seriously. We really do. So thank you. This show is brought to you by Midwest Memoirs. If you have wondered how the stories of the people you love most will live on after they are gone, Midwest Memoirs can help you. We help capture the most precious memories of your loved ones as told in their voice. And it's done with the research of your family member and completed through a professionally guided interview in a studio. Sometimes we travel and, of course, using state-of-the-art recording equipment. So the most important stories that you will ever hear are those of the people that we love most. And, you know, Jonah had this idea because of his grandma, and he was able to do it, interview his grandma for her stories to live on. And unfortunately, my grandma and my dad have passed away. And so those stories that I wanted to capture, I'm on the other side where I wish I would have been able to do it. So it's a huge thing. And it's the one place I really get emotional, right?
Yeah, we're very honored that people welcome us into their lives to help their families tell these stories, to capture the history, to capture the lineage. I think of it like, I like to think it's like a 60-minute style interview conducted by Don and or myself for your family member. And the other thing I was thinking about recently, just real quick here, is that this isn't just for grandmas, grandpas, mothers, and fathers. Something that struck me is that a lot of our guests with this are in they're elderly, right? And that their stories are important, but it also sometimes illustrates how much we can forget over time.
For sure.
And it's found me thinking like, geez, do I need to sit down and do a memoir, because what am I going to forget in 30 years?
Right.
Like it, the way things change over time. So yeah, these memoirs are special. We appreciate those who've brought us in with their families, and please contact us if that's something that sounds interesting to you.
If you guys want to know how morbid I am, my sister and I have a fair amount of childhood trauma. And I was like, hey, perhaps we should record our trauma. Wouldn't that be incredible? And I have been to therapy. She has not. And so she's like, no, that is ridiculous. And I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll just do mine. So, yeah, we can do it all anyway. Yeah. So, okay. So let's get into it. Hey, I just said my biggest pet peeve. I hate on TikTok when people are like, let's get into it. And I just did it.
Are we going to dive in?
Let's dive in. All right. So we are covering a full time frame in today's case, spanning 1973 to 1975, and of course, before then as well. So I'm going to go through just a couple of the years. In 1973, the U.S. ended its place in the Vietnam War. Roe v. Wade was ruled on by the Supreme Court. Occupation of Wounded Knee at Pine Ridge Reservation took place. The World Trade Center opened in New York City. And the world learned about the Watergate scandal. And of course, that wouldn't be the only scandal of the Nixon administration, because that same year, Vice President Spiro Agnew resigned that same year after being shamed for taking bribes, tax evasion, and all around corruption.
Wow.
Yeah. Was it 1973 or 2024? Whatever. Yeah. In 1974, then moving on, President Nixon claimed that he was not a crook, but also resigned. So.
They're all
still kind of guilty. Happy Days debuted. I can still sing the theme song, and I wasn't even born then. The first Vietnam War veteran was elected to the U.S. Congress, John Murtha of Pennsylvania. I fly out of his airport a lot. So thank you for your name. And I never knew actually why it was named that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I just learned something there.
Yeah, you're welcome. Postage was raised from 8 cents to 10 cents.
The audacity.
It costs nearly $1 to mail a frickin' letter now. It's like, it's a lot of money, but I sound elderly myself, but you know what I mean? It's like, it's a letter. And Hank Aaron tied Babe Ruth's home run record.
1974, okay.
1974, yep. And 1975, Margaret Thatcher took over as prime minister in the UK. Raise your hand if you've watched The Crown. Yeah, I know. Thank you. Yeah. I feel like I'm from the UK now after watching that. That was a very American thing to say. I'm sorry.
Are you going to start doing this show in an accent?
No, that would be horrible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you already do it in an accent.
Midwest accent.
That's right.
I'm going to call myself an expert in, but yeah, if I made it into a UK or British accent, I would have to kick my own ass for that.
Maybe you could even say maybe people would want to put thumbtacks in their ears instead of hear that.
Yeah, maybe.
Kind of like some people's voices.
Yeah. The U.S. started withdrawing troops in Vietnam, even though we had pulled out 2 years earlier, and Saturday Night Live debuted.
Nice.
Yeah, so it was 75. And a reminder for those of you here, I posted the photo. So when I looked like I was texting, that's what I was doing. So I've posted the photo, so make sure you tag yourselves, okay? I haven't received any notifications yet, and I'm just waiting for them. Okay. All right. So according to author and criminal justice expert Peter Vronsky, 80% of American serial killers that we are aware of operated between 1970 and 1999.
Oh.
Yeah. And he found common links. Those born during wartime, those predisposed to violence, and likely raised in potentially violent, broken homes. And I hate the term broken homes, divorced homes, but I was using his words. But of course, it isn't that simple. Experts, namely neuroscientist James Fallon, not Jimmy Fallon, found that those with personality disorders are almost wired for violence and aggression. So with the right environment, specifically abuse, a parent with PTSD, an overbearing mother, with that combination, it's a perfect storm.
Oh man, this is chilling already.
So why does that shift? And why did the years change, right? Changes happened, and society realized that hitchhiking was not safe, so women stopped. Then home security systems swept the neighborhoods. So people like, the Night Stalker, you know, if you got a security system, not breaking into homes, right? And the victim pool, because of that, severely downsized. And then predators focused on sex workers, right? They're likely not to be missed, and they voluntarily get into cars, and so it's a perfect storm.
The thing about the hitchhiking that always kind of surprised me with some of the other hitchhiking circumstances we've had and what we've learned is that oftentimes it was the hitchhiker who was dangerous, not the person picking up the hitchhiker.
At times, yeah, yeah. But I mean, even when we were growing up in the 80s, it's like, oh, I can't hitchhike. Absolutely not. You know, someone's going to murder me. Yeah. So Harvey Kerrigan was born in Fargo, North Dakota in May 1927 to an unwed 20-year-old mom. If you were an unwed mother in the 20s, you were considered ruined and life was difficult, to put it lightly. The 1913 Mental Deficiency Act allowed unmarried mothers to be labeled as, quote, moral imbeciles.
Holy.
And to be sent to asylums.
Ooh, that's a little harsh.
What year do you think that was stopped?
Oh, I'm terrified to guess.
It was
1950?
It was in the late 60s.
Oof.
Yeah. Yeah, I really should start a different podcast sometimes so I can go off my tangents. It might just be me listening, but fine. It drives me, I just couldn't believe that it was the 60s that ended. Just for being an unwed mother, because
these poor women.
Yeah, they take the brunt of it all.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when Kerrigan was approximately 3 or 4 years old, his mother remarried and had another son with her new husband. And it didn't seem as though Kerrigan was the favorite child. In fact, he was looked at more like a burden because of his chronic bedwetting and as a bit of a troubled, odd child because of his imaginary friend named Paul.
Oh.
So I'm not sure what kind of stuff Paul pulled, but he seemed to be a bit of a turkey.
This might be the first appearance of an imaginary friend on a Midwest murder show.
We all had one, but...
Did
I mean,
we?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I named mine, but...
Oh.
Yeah.
Mine's still sitting out there.
I was going to say, like, now, like, as soon as I said that, I was like, God, I feel weird. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. Okay.
Don't worry. Mine showed up, so yours isn't alone.
Okay. Oh, good. Good. Thank you. Thanks. So in addition to the chronic bedwetting, I mean, and the friend Paul, like, it was just not a good situation that, or not a good light that they portrayed him in, I guess I should say. And so that paired with him being much smaller than his classmates at 6 years old and also having a twitch in his face.
Oh,
he wasn't exactly the popular kid.
This poor kid.
Yeah. So in response, Kerrigan was sent away a lot as a child. At 8 years old, he was sent to live with his aunt and uncle in Cavalier, North Dakota. And after a short while, he was sent back home to his mother. At 10, he was sent to live with his grandma in Williams, North Dakota. And then to a different aunt's, and then home again. If you can call his mother's home home.
Right.
I guess at that point.
Doesn't sound like he was overly welcome there.
No, I don't think so. And so, no surprise, after being bounced around, he was somewhat of a lost child, and he was still a chronic bedwetter. And so, I mean, you're talking into 10, 11, you know. But he took it a step further and leveled up to stealing. So now he was into theft.
Okay.
And so at 11 years old, he was sent to Mandan, North Dakota, to a reform school where he'd stay for 7 years. It's now known as YCC. And
that's a long stint.
Mm-hmm. 7 years he was there, yeah. During his time there, he claimed he was sexually abused by female employees.
Oh.
And I have a question on this. So it was the 30s. I didn't realize that women were allowed out of the house yet. Especially to work at a facility like that.
I was told a few
and
minutes
also,
ago a
I
lot
thought
of them
that would have been funnier,
imbeciles.
You guys. Come on. Yeah. Oh, it wasn't because it was true? Is that right? Is that how that worked? Okay, I see it now. Yeah. So during his time at the reform school, he was also diagnosed with a nervous disorder called chorea, which causes muscular twitching of the arms, legs, and face. Another relatively traumatic characteristic that would make him different from his peers and make him stand out. So when Kerrigan left the reform school at the age of 18 and in 1947, he enlisted in the army and was subsequently stationed at Fort Richardson in Anchorage, Alaska. On July 31st, 1949, a man walking home in Anchorage saw a man and a woman laying together in a park along his route. So when he stepped towards them, he wanted to make sure that they were okay. The man on the ground raised a fist in the air and told him to leave them alone. So the next morning at approximately 6 a.m., the witness from the night before went by the park where he saw the two people on his way home. In the grass lay a semi-nude woman, dead.
Oh.
So here this Good Samaritan is like, you know, going over there to check to make sure everything is okay and was told to go away. And here she had died. He had killed her. Or that's what one would assume anyway. So 57-year-old Laura Showatler had been sexually assaulted prior to being hit in the head numerous times with what appeared to have been a hammer. The police had no leads other than the man's eyewitness testimony. On September 14th, a few months later, a large man attempted to rape Christine Norton, but she was able to get away. And details seemed to match the rape and murder of Laura Showatler, so similar, you know, characteristics and details matched up. And Christine was able to add to them and kind of fill in the blanks a little bit.
And you haven't mentioned how large this dude is, Kerrigan. Is he?
I haven't.
Is he a big dude?
He's a big fella.
Okay.
He's a big fella. Yeah. I'll get there. Yeah. Christine told police an intoxicated soldier came up to her at approximately 7 a.m. and subsequently attacked her. And there was one person who seemed to match the details. Harvey Kerrigan was not the meek, twitchy little boy that he once was. When Kerrigan grew up, he grew up into a large fella, and he was 6'2 and about 290 pounds. So far from a small guy. On September 16th, he was brought in for a lineup, and both the eyewitness from Laura's case, as well as Christine, were brought in. And almost immediately, he was arrested and charged with attempted rape of Christine Norton. After he was arrested, he was questioned about Laura's assault and murder, but he refused to talk. The next day, officers brought him to the U.S. Marshal's office, where he was questioned again about Laura. And after an hour, he asked to speak to a priest, but said he still wanted to make the statement. So after the priest came, the marshal gave him paper and a couple of pencils before being placed in a cell alone until Sunday the 18th. So this is like one day later, right? So then Monday morning rolled around, and he was asked if he had written his statement. He had, but it made no mention of Laura Showatler. So he talked about what he had done. He had talked about what he had done that day, but did not mention Laura at all. So he was willing to speak about her, though, and he did admit to beating Laura with only his fists. So they moved forward with charging him, and he was convicted in 1950 of the attempted rape of Christine Norton and rape and first-degree murder of Laura Showalter. For the rape and murder of Laura, he was sentenced to death by hanging. So in Alaska, this is in 1949.
Yeah, that's intense.
Unfortunately, it wouldn't last. After an appeal was filed, the Supreme Court vacated his death sentence. They ruled that Kerrigan's confession was unlawfully obtained, and according to the appeal, the U.S. Marshal assured Kerrigan that if he confessed, he would not be executed. He would remain behind bars for the attempted rape conviction and was then transferred to Alcatraz in 1952.
Wow.
So, I think we all know that the story does not end here. And so, the marshal, the reason this whole case was overturned was because he said that if he confessed, he would not be executed. He swore up and down that he did not say that. However, other things pointed to him actually saying so. So if he would have, if that death sentence and that sentence itself would not have been vacated, he would not have been out of prison.
But he was going to hang.
Mm-hmm.
They were serious up there in Alaska about that.
Yeah. So he would remain in Alcatraz for 8 years, and after he was paroled in 1960, he moved to Minnesota. Why not try a new state to be a shitbag in, right? Yeah.
Whoa.
So he went from Alaska to Minnesota. Yeah. Fargo, Alaska, Minnesota.
I'm surprised at the, okay, if vacating the death sentence is one thing, but they vacated it and now it's not even life in prison?
He served some time, so he was still paroled.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he did it. Yep. He did some time, Don.
He did his time.
He did his time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Time to that. I bet he got super rehabilitated there in Alcatraz.
Well, that's what I want to ask you.
I have to imagine Alcatraz is one of America's greatest rehab centers.
Right.
Are you kidding me?
Right.
If Alcatraz can't turn someone into a not rapist murderer, I don't know what can.
And so I want to ask you, Jonah, do you think the old Harvey the Hammer got himself right and was considered rehabilitated?
Oh, Harvey the Hammer, no.
And also, I did not come up with that nickname, by the way.
That's probably the media gave him that nickname, and we should call him Harvey the Pisser. Not to make fun of pissers, because I can relate to it, but we got to stop giving serial killers good names. I'm sorry, we do. Killers deserve awful names.
We shouldn't even say their names.
Right.
Don't even say their name.
Right, but we have to in the case of this. But no, I'm really, my prediction, zero rehab has occurred. Maybe the bedwetting problem is gone. I'm guessing the imaginary friend was there with him in Alcatraz.
Hey,
I don't know. Mine's still here with me, so I can't judge. I can't judge him for that.
I still talk to myself, so I'm not sure if that counts as an imaginary friend. But
no, yeah. It's just your only friend.
I mean, you don't need to
Come
be mean
on.
About it.
I know it's not a roast up here.
No,
you're right.
Gosh,
I'm your friend, Dawn.
Anyway, I don't know if I want you to be my friend.
No rehab in Alcatraz. I'm sorry.
No, and
that's
you'd
not
be correct
happening.
Because yeah. 4 months, four,
oh,
four
Jesus,
months.
No.
And I think I can even do that math. That's 120 days. Yeah. Ish. Give her.
Carry the one.
Yeah.
Like maybe.
So 4 months after being paroled, he was arrested for burglary, assault, and attempted rape. So he was eventually convicted and sentenced to 2.5 years in a Minnesota state prison and then federally sentenced to 2,086 days in federal prison in Leavenworth, Kansas.
2.5 years?
Yeah.
Did repeat offending not matter in this era?
Because in the 60s, I know he did not read ahead. He does not read ahead. I actually put here, in the 60s, the men in charge didn't seem to understand that a repeat violent offender has a high chance of reoffending. Yeah. Yeah. And so, Kerrigan was paroled again in 1964.
No.
Yes. And instead of remaining in Minnesota, he went to a different state. He moved far, far away from home to Seattle, Washington, where he worked at a gas station.
I mean, why not?
Sure. Seems right. So, Jonah, I'm going to ask you again. Do you think he was rehabilitated?
Did he go to church?
He was a Catholic. He did He had faith.
The only way I would believe he might be rehabbed in this situation was if he found Jailhouse Jesus during that last 2.5 year stint.
Yep. No, I think he found the real one. He did not wait for Jailhouse. It was the one on the outside.
If he already had real Jesus and he's still doing this shit, no rehab is coming.
Well, you would be right again, because in November of 1964, right? So he got out in 64. So later that year, he was arrested for second-degree burglary, convicted, and sentenced to 15 years at Walla Walla Penitentiary.
Okay, we're getting better here.
We're getting better. And here, he started to better himself and also received his GED. So good job.
Yeah.
How many years do you think he served?
Oh, man. Usually in these situations, it's about 3 years.
Mm-hmm. 4. He served less than 4 of his 15 years before he was paroled again in 1968.
And the only reason he received his GED is because he let his imaginary friend take the test.
So at least this time, he was armed with education. He got his GED, so, I mean, good on ya. Right?
Armed with education.
And
put down the hammer, pick up a book.
Yeah, that is excellent, actually. Yeah, and at that point, he was ready to settle down, because in 1969, he married Sheila Moran, who was recently widowed. He moved in with Sheila and her daughter, and almost immediately, he was abusive to both Sheila and his new stepdaughter. And the marriage was not destined for forever, if you can believe that. He didn't communicate, and when he was particularly moody, he would get up in the middle of the night and creep through the darkness, driving around for long periods of time. His excuse was because he wanted to, quote, to be alone and think. When his wife would ask where he went, he refused to say. So really good husband quality there, for sure.
Yeah.
So the newlyweds were not even a year into their marriage when his stepdaughter ran away from home because of the abuse. And you guessed it, Corrigan was arrested for a parole violation Corrigan was arrested for a parole violation as well as suspicion of robbery because he can't stop stealing things or abusing people at that point too. So those charges would land him back in Walla Walla, but for just 1 year this time. And at this point, it gave Sheila the opportunity to divorce him.
Well, at least she got the divorce.
Mm-hmm. The divorce. Yeah. And she got the heck out of Dodge. She moved to Canada and was like, I'm done. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good. So good for her.
Good choice.
Yeah. So in April of 1972, he's out again. And he married Alice Johnson and moved in with her and her two kids, 14-year-old Georgia and 11-year-old Billy. After 2 months, Billy moved out to live with his biological father because of the abuse from Carrignan.
Where do they meet him? Where do you meet this guy?
Also, and I don't know what it was in the 60s, 70s, like that time frame, where it was like, here, meet your new daddy, where he's moving in. I don't understand that, you know, and it's certainly not saying that these parents or these mothers didn't want to protect their children. You know, one is a widow, right? Bills are on her own. She's a single, like both are single moms at that point. One is playing mom and dad, you know, so I understand the need of at times to have a partner. But also your kids are there, and he's beaten the heck out of both of them, or one of them in one case. So much so that one ran away. The next one, your son moved with his biological father. And I'm not blaming the mothers at all. I mean, for crying out loud, if they had ended up pregnant 5 years ago, they could have been put in an asylum.
A sanitarium,
So I understand the limits, right? But, wow.
I mean, we're in 72. I mean, I don't even know if women could open their own checking account yet.
Yeah, I feel like it was around that time, maybe a couple of years later. But it's so sad, you know, and it's, if they felt that he was their only option.
Was he good looking?
No.
Oh. Oh.
No.
Okay.
No.
No. So he was just... real smooth talker then, like really.
I mean, maybe, Anyway, and I will try to find the good in anybody. Like, oh, look at those eyelashes you have. You know, this guy had the eyebrows of like Abe Vigoda. You know, if you know what I mean. Like they were caterpillars. Like on the top of his eyes, and not that that's what makes him unattractive. His entire face did that for him, but
Oh,
I mean,
man.
You can only be like so good of a smooth talker. So I don't, and obviously I have all the facts, so it's easier for me to be like, that was dumb. But he was not good looking. Even a little bit. I'm sure some of you are even Googling him right now and you can just smile. Yeah, I see one down here. Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, actually, will you hold that? John, will you hold that one more time? That's him.
Oh.
Yeah, huh?
Okay. Yeah, he's very weathered,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah. That's a nice way of saying that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
A lot of cringe faces out there. That's okay.
Yes. You're welcome.
No offense, but. Mm-hmm. Okay, he's finding his way through.
Yeah, and please...
And out of jail constantly.
I have to say this again.
Do you think that's why he kept getting out of jail? Because they got tired of looking at his face? Get that one out of here.
I'm sure some of the parole board fellas that were there probably looked equally as handsome as him. So, no, okay. I don't think that was why.
Okay, I didn't play into it.
And please know, I have to say this again. I'm not faulting these women. It is a general question and more of a generational thing, because it is just how that worked back then, right? And it was very common back then, I should say. So in October of 1972, they were married in April. So this is October of 1972. 19-year-old Leslie Brock set out to hitchhike near Bellingham, Washington. She was last seen getting into a pickup with a silver canopy. The pickup was easily recognizable due to a pipe sticking out near the gas tank, and the person driving was a middle-aged white man with gigantic eyebrows. That was one of the eyewitness testimonies did comment on his eyebrows, so I'm really hammering that home, and I did not mean to say the word hammer. I was not trying to make a joke out of that, I swear. I swear I was not. Anyway... Hours after she was seen getting into the pickup, her body was found just off an old logging road. Her body was naked with the exception of her knee-high stockings. The left side of her head had been bludgeoned, but there was evidence that she had fought back. In one of her hands, she grasped strands of gray-brown hair, thought to be chest hair from her attacker. A year into the marriage... to Alice Johnson, he was again faced with a failed marriage and divorce, but this time it was because his wife Alice suspected her husband had murdered a young woman. On May 1st, 1973, 15-year-old Kathy Miller was looking for a summer job, so she went to the want ads and started going down the list. The one that caught her eye was for a service station, the same service station that Kerrigan leased. Kathy left her family after school, went to the interview, but never returned home. When Kerrigan was questioned, he said she never showed. After a very, very long month, Kathy Miller's remains were found by two boys who were hiking. They stumbled upon Kathy's naked body wrapped in a plastic sheet. Her skull had been beaten with what was believed to have been a hammer because of the nickel-sized holes in her skull. And she had also been sexually assaulted.
This is all very difficult to hear, and I'm still a little hung up on the fact that Alice divorced him because she thought he murdered somebody, and I guess she never told anyone?
She did. She talked to the authorities.
She did, okay.
She talked to the authorities.
That was a difficult leap for me. Like, Alice left him because she thought he murdered a young woman, and then here we are May 1st,
the whole time
and he's doing it again.
The whole time she was talking, but she... When she started to suspect it, it was because of Kathy Miller.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So Kerrigan had been questioned by authorities, but nothing could tie him to the murders of Laura Brock and Kathy Miller. But he was definitely a suspect. And of course, this is the 70s. you know, taking a person's, you know, hair, right? They can't teach us anything, right? So that just sat there. Those cases just sat there. And not
might
to,
even
not,
be safe to assume they have no idea the shit he did up in Alaska.
They did. They knew.
Okay.
They knew.
Good.
But they couldn't pin him to these murders. So Kerrigan, of course, you know, had been questioned at that point, and then Alice was done with him. And then he's like, okay, well, peace. I'm out. I'm going to go. I'm going to leave the state. And he told investigators that he was heading to Colorado. And Alice, of course, having been abused and everything, was beyond relieved. But here are these two open cases that are just there. So Kathy Miller's family is just beyond sick. You know, her mother actually went on to be a huge advocate for victims, huge advocate. And there was nothing that they could do at that point, and they couldn't stop him from leaving. So instead of going to Colorado, he went to California instead. And during the months of May and July 1973, the time that Kerrigan was proven to be in California thanks to a speeding ticket, four naked female bodies were found. However, there was no way to prove Kerrigan was involved. So by June of 1973, he was in Minnesota, and 47-year-old Marlis Townsend met him in a bus stop. While waiting for the bus, she noticed someone show up behind her completely out of nowhere, and just as she was going to turn around, something hit her in the back of the head, and she fell to the ground unconscious. When she regained consciousness, she was in a pickup, and behind the wheel was a large, balding man. Noticing she was awake, he grabbed her hand and forced it to his genitals. She tried to pull away, reaching for the door handle. At that point, he grabbed her by the hair, but unbeknownst to him, she was wearing a wig.
Oh. That's out of a movie.
That is out of this, yeah. As I was reading this part of the book that I read, by Anne Rule, actually, it was fascinating because, like, that was my first thought. I was like, oh my gosh, yeah. It's like, as she's reaching for the door handle, he's got her hair. And so in the book, she actually says, like, literally saved by a hair, right? And so, yeah. So, excuse me. So she tumbled out and at that point started to run. Looking behind her at the pickup, she took note of the silver camper on the back. The male that tried to attack her was likely in his late 40s with brown hair that was graying. So in September of 1973, he has, you know, of course, again, he's in Minnesota, right? And so 13-year-old Jerry Billings from Duluth was hitchhiking in Minneapolis to go see her boyfriend.
Oh, at 13? Did you say 13?
It was the 70s, man. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Along came a pickup with a silver cover, and Jerry happily hopped in. Like, this story is one of the main reasons why hitchhiking came to an abrupt halt. I mean, it was easy to pick up hitchhikers, right?
Well, him and the Raines brothers from...
Right, from the last time we were here.
Seriously, yeah.
So he seemed to be friendly and said he'd drop her off wherever she needed to, or needed to go. And so they drove along, and almost immediately she noticed that they weren't going where they were supposed to be. They weren't heading in the right direction. And so while driving, he forced her to perform oral sex. He then raped her with the hammer that he had in his pickup and forced her to perform oral sex again. And at that point, he hit her with the hammer in the head. They drove for quite a while in the country, and just when Jerry was convinced that he was going, that this person was going to kill her, he stopped and told her to get out. He picked her up and carried her far into the field, and he dropped her on the ground. After attempting to rape her, he left her laying on the ground and left her for dead. This poor 13-year-old girl. So Eileen Hunley was next to meet him. She was from Kansas, but moved to Minneapolis in March 1973. She was working at a daycare center when she met Harvey Kerrigan, and she was looking for a ride with a couple of friends. He was kind, and of course that stuck out to her, even more so that he claimed to be Catholic. He was a kind man of faith. What could go wrong?
So it was the kindness that was getting these people. Like, it's so creepy. It makes my skin crawl.
So they started a very, very close relationship in May 1974, which they maintained through the summer. When Kerrigan started to show his true colors, because they all do, Eileen ended the relationship in August. August. Nobody saw her after August 10th. Until 5 weeks later, when her decomposing remains were found in Shelburne County. I'm really sorry about this next part. She had been sexually assaulted with a tree branch, and her head had been crushed with a hammer. Usually we put stop points in here for one another. It just keeps going. And unfortunately, Kerrigan was far from finished. On September 8th, 1974, 17-year-old Janie Lynch and 16-year-old Lisa King were hitchhiking on Lake Street in Minneapolis when Kerrigan picked them up. He drove them toward the city limits, and when they got there, he stopped the car and hit June's head and face with a hammer. During the attack, Lisa managed to escape, and as soon as Kerrigan noticed what was happening, he pushed June out of the car and sped off. So they both survived.
He's getting really desperate and sloppy at this point here.
Well, notice the timeline as I just pay attention to the dates that I'm about to say.
Okay.
So at this point, he seemed to be escalating as far as time frame goes. And he was likely angry with his two latest victims escaping. And on September 14th, 1974, when Kerrigan was roaming the Minneapolis area, because that's just what he did, he came across Gwen Burton in the Sears parking lot at Chicago and Lake. She was having car trouble, and so he shows up driving a green Chevy Caprice, and after he wasn't able to fix her car issues for her, she said but that he would be able to if they went and got the parts that he needed to fix it. She said she couldn't pay him because she had just purchased a gift in Sears, where she was, and it took most of her cash. He didn't seem bothered and even said, nope, no big deal, and offered her a ride to come along with him to grab the things that he needed. Immediately, she was frightened. Like, she just knew that something was off, something was wrong. And while driving, he began to rip off parts of her clothing and then choked her until she was near unconscious, and then sexually assaulted her with the hammer, as he had done in the past to others. He dropped her body in a field not far from the Sears that he picked her up from. Little did he know, though, that she survived and crawled to the side of the road for help. Only 4 days later now, on September 18th, so his timeline is escalating. It is just climbing.
This is 4 days.
Mm-hmm. He saw 18-year-old Sally Versailles hitchhiking. He came upon her and offered her $25. He would give her a ride and give her $25 to help him pick up a car at a different location and drive it back for him. Sally was interested in that amount of money. It was $25. But said that she needed to pick up her friend, Diane Flynn. So he was chatting with them on their way to the other vehicle. Even though he was strange, he was still kind, right? The conversation was strange, but he was kind. And then a switch was flipped at that point. He asked them, quote, if you had a choice, would you rather be raped or killed?
Oh, Jesus.
Almost instantly, both girls said, quote, we'd rather be killed. When one of the girls asked how far away they were, almost complaining that it was taking so long and saying that, like, for $25, this isn't really worth it if we're going to go much longer, right? He backhanded her in the face. And obviously getting sloppy because he didn't have a full tank of gas, he needed to stop at that point for gas, and the girls managed at that point to get out of the car and run into the station for help. Then Kerrigan, of course, fled in his car. On September 20th, 2 days later, Kathy Schultz was on her way to classes when Kerrigan came upon her. She had been hitchhiking between 54th and Lindale. Her family didn't know what she had worn. She was missing, but they knew that she always wore a red bandana. When they went to her room to look for clothing that might be gone, they noticed that her red bandana was gone, and so they knew that that's what she was wearing. The next day, her remains were found in a cornfield approximately 40 miles from Minneapolis. Her skull had been beaten in with most likely a hammer. When Kerrigan was questioned about her, they asked if he had picked up a hitchhiker, and he said, yep, sure did, you know, but I don't know what she was wearing. They asked, like, do you know what she was wearing? He's like, nope, I'm not sure, but definitely a red bandana. They hadn't published that.
Oh.
So, sadly...
And he's still driving the same vehicle.
Same green Caprice.
Through all
yeah.
of this.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, well, he switched from a pickup to the Chevy Caprice.
All right. So, man, it bothers me that he fled in his car on the 18th and they couldn't... And within 2 days, no one saw that car to pick him up?
It was all happening. It was all happening really fast because,
right. yeah.
because the day that he took Kathy Schultz, the other girls, you know, had just come in the day before, you know, and you're dealing with different precincts, all that stuff. I mean, so it's all happening very, very quickly.
And I wanted to be clear. You said Jerry Billings was left for dead.
Mm-hmm.
Was she actually dead or?
She survived.
Okay.
She survived. Yep. And shared her statement. But sadly, looking back, Kathy had always felt like she would die young. In fact, she talked about it. She talked about it with other people.
Well, that's ominous.
And she had even written poems about it. In her room, they found a couple of them. One of them reads, "When I go away, maybe today or tomorrow, I'll just fly away so I won't have to say so long." And the other one said, "Put a white rose on my grave and talk to me of good times. Don't cry, but be brave. For we only have one lifetime. Put a white rose on my grave and talk to me of good times. Think of all the love we gave and our lovely walks in springtime."
That's really beautiful.
She's 19 years old,
yeah.
you know, and having that amount of, you know, foresight or whatever you want to call it, I guess, at that point. So when the victims, the surviving ones, of course, gave their statements to police, they all gave a similar description. But unfortunately, there was a lookalike. There was another fellow who looked a lot like Harvey Kerrigan.
That's too bad for him.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah.
Face only a mother could love, but
right. He had a face for radio.
Not really, because
yeah.
dude's mom
yeah.
pretty much ushered
didn't,
him out.
Didn't
so.
Love him? Yeah.
Yeah, I rescind that statement.
Yeah. yeah.
A face, not even his mother could love
a face
his
not
face.
Even a mother could love,
yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
It's the other way.
So when it came time for the victims to do a photo lineup, all of the victims said the photo of the lookalike fella looked a lot like him, but it wasn't him. So luckily he was off the hook.
Let me guess, the lookalike did not have the bushy eyebrows.
I'm not sure what the difference
okay.
was, actually.
Okay.
So the description that his last two survivors gave was very detailed, and it matched the same one of Gwen Burton. They said he smoked constantly, and that he had numerous scruffy, unshaven areas on his face and neck with sideburns, and as well as deep furrows in his cheeks, along with a dimple in his chin.
This is a good description.
A very good description. And if you look at the picture, it's pretty accurate.
Yes.
Investigators in Minneapolis had received word at that point that Kerrigan had been a suspect and connected to the same caliber of murders. And so at this time, they had also put out, you know, an APB on this car. So not like they're paying attention to this. They're doing good police work. They're investigating.
Good.
And so these two.
I feel like I needed to hear that.
Yeah. These two. I mean, it's pertinent information, so it's good. I'm happy to share it. So these two cops are out driving along and they see this green Chevy Caprice and. There's this guy that's kind of looking at them. They stop and they stop right there with him. And this guy is looking out from a diner. And so they decide to go in and chat with him and just see, you know, maybe it's not him. Maybe it isn't him. And when they go in, they're talking to the cook. And he's like, "Do you know the guy who is driving this car?" And he goes, "Yeah, he just walked out the back door."
Oh.
And so when they walked out,
just
the car
snuck
was
out
missing.
The back.
The car was missing. So they had come close a couple of times.
He's a kind but not entirely stupid creep. Like
just wait, because it's eerie how intelligent he actually is. So again, they know they. So at this point, they're starting to talk with investigators in Washington and really compare stories, and it's becoming clear how dangerous this person actually is. And once they realized that Kerrigan was a common denominator, they searched his home and found maps with approximately 181 red circles drawn in isolated areas of the U.S. and Canada.
I'm uncomfortable. Holy shit.
Yeah. Some led to nothing, but others matched where he had applied for jobs or even made vehicle purchases, which matched this or had similar areas or similar as to where people or women had disappeared.
So that is becomes a very massive investigation to follow up on every single one of these red dots. And I imagine maybe at some point he shares what some of those were, but that's sprawling to try to identify these things.
I mean, they cross-referenced people had or women had gone missing.
Wow.
Right. And some matched up, others just didn't. So, but my question is, okay, so if they didn't match up with something or, you know, obvious, they had to match up with something. It was circled for a reason. And yeah, so do we just not know about that?
Like, what was it?
Yeah. So one circle in particular marked matched where Laura Brock disappeared. That was the very first woman that we talked about. And of course, there were other women that had gone missing in the circles that he was still not connected to.
And were there ones in California? Were the four women that you mentioned?
That I'm not sure of.
Okay.
That I'm not sure of. Yeah. So when he was eventually charged, he was only charged with the murders of Eileen Hunley and Catherine Schultz because they knew for a fact they could get him on those. The murders in Washington were never tried. He was also charged with numerous counts of indecent liberties, sodomy upon or with a child, and two counts of aggravated sodomy. In all, he was sentenced to 30 years in prison as well as, and that was for the sodomy charges, as well as a maximum of 40 years for the murders.
And how many murders was he then sentenced for?
Just the two.
And
so
at this point,
they're
saying, we suspect him in all of these other murders.
Yeah.
Very difficult to pin him at this time without some of that forensic evidence that we're used to now.
Yeah. Sure. Yep. And so the whole time I'm asking why though, right? Obviously he has mommy issues. But it was because of his relationship with his mother caused this intense hatred for women. Intense hatred. And clearly was mentally unwell, especially when he claimed that he felt or he was visited by God and was told to do this. And so he truly felt that he was doing God's work by getting rid of, these are his words, not mine, the whores and harlots.
Jeez.
Yeah. So
it's doing God's work. This guy said that.
By ridding the earth of whores and harlots.
Now he's not, he's not crossing wires. God wasn't his imaginary friend, was it?
Not that I'm aware of it. Just Paul.
Okay.
Just Paul.
So,
yeah. Just one of the disciples, I guess, if that's what you want. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
So he was interviewed numerous times by psychology students, by psychology departments, by psychologists, all of that. And I found the transcripts for one interview. And they asked him a multitude of questions, but I just put in the ones that I found a little bit ironic even, or maybe a little more telling than the others. And so they asked who his childhood heroes were. John Dillinger.
Okay, murderer, bank robber.
Yeah. Okay. Babyface Nelson. And J. Edgar Hoover.
Does one of these not belong, or is it just me?
Do any of them not belong? I mean, Babyface Nelson and John Dillinger.
I don't remember Babyface Nelson as well. He's another robber. Is that his deal, a bank robber guy?
Yeah, he was a little mobster from the 30s or whatever, 20s or 30s. Mm-hmm. wouldn't that be crappy to get the nickname of Babyface? I'm this tough guy, but my name's Babyface.
So these are his heroes.
Yeah, these are his heroes. And he said more so John Dillinger and Babyface than J. Edgar Hoover.
Oh, he had a pecking order for these
He
guys.
Had a pecking order, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. His most treasured honor was to be loved by a good woman.
That is so gross, I want to throw my laptop.
Don't. That no, was,
I'm not
that
going
was him,
to.
Not my necklace, you guys. That was him, not my necklace. Hobbies before going to prison. Murdering women was not one of them. It was music and travel.
Oh. So that's code for murdering and
women.
Raping women.
Yes. What is... Also, who asked him this question? But what is your advice to kids?
What?
And his answer is equally as gaspy. Do not have parents.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's weird.
Yeah. I find this is my favorite answer, if you will, but the most ironic, I guess, is maybe a better way to say it. What don't you like about people? Their arrogance and feeling of superiority over other animals. And so that, to me, feels like the most telling about this garbage dump of a human being is their arrogance and feeling of superiority. But yet, he killed how many women?
Evidently, we don't know.
How many women? Exactly.
Yeah.
We don't even know.
It seems like double digits to me. I'm guessing they don't put that many on him officially, but this sounds like a double-digit killer that went for almost a decade.
This is by far the most victims that I think I have covered. The only one that might rival it is maybe the one in Ohio, but I didn't count them out. But also we don't know. We don't know.
Yeah, because so many of these missing women, again, there was just no way to massively pursue it. And of course, at some point, all of the effort and time and money and person power it takes to pursue individually each one of these and link him to it, I guess I'd almost be curious to see if there's any level of DNA linking in the modern era that would connect him to some of these. But back then, you get him for what you can.
Well, and I'm sure that was a conversation with the victims' families of, we know that we can get him for these. You know, is it better to be acquitted on your daughter's murder or to be, you know, put in prison for this?
Right.
Yeah. And again, I have to point out that if that one marshal wouldn't have told him that, none of this would have happened.
This guy was supposed to hang.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not one to condemn anyone, but this guy was supposed to hang.
If I can make this story that much worse, he died at the age of 95 on March 6th, 2023.
Holy
barely
shit.
Barely a year ago.
And he looks mean as hell.
He looks mean. It's nice that he lost his eyebrows later in life, but yeah. He looks mean. Like, his eyes are, you can see the bottoms of the whites of his eyes, which is sometimes a tell that things just aren't quite right.
It's so almost like mentally. An exaggerated, like, Dick Tracy villain face.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one.
Mm-hmm. I'm the guy. Once
Just
in a while,
guy.
I get one.
Yeah.
Oh.
So that is the story of Harvey Kerrigan, and that's the last time I ever want to say his name. Because it's more about his victims than him.
One of the most repulsive humans that has ever been on this show.
Yeah. Sources for today's case: onthisday.com for the timeline, Rolling Stone court documents, murderpedia.org, The Want Ad Killer, Harvey Kerrigan by Anne Rule. I highly recommend the book. It is very good. The Serial Killers, which is a TV series. The episode that I watched on here is from 1994.
Wow.
I was 10 years old when that came out, and it's like Seinfeld wrote the music for it. It is the same music, and that's all I could focus on was the music. And I was like, I think they're saying things, but I cannot focus. It was like Larry David wrote it. It was 1994. We'll just say that. Herald.net and Merriam-Webster.
Can I ask a quick question about that? Do you know why she called him the want ad killer? We never heard any want. I never heard a want ad.
If you would have paid attention, you would have.
Did I miss that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I was like so. My brain is twisted by this case. He did a lot of want ads.
Kathy Miller. That was a big when.
So it was just the one though. Like it.
There were there's speculation that there were others. But,
so this guy was perhaps using a bunch of want ads. Yeah. In various ways.
There's speculation of that.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's like the 70s version of a Craigslist killer, right?
I mean,
for the modern era. Merch, buy some. There's some out that way. We'll be out there for pictures. So grab a shirt or while you're out. And hoodies and crew necks are on sale, you guys. Let's help move those, please. Or you can go to TooManyShirts.com/MidwestMurder. This episode is written by myself, Don Palumbo. Midwest Murder is hosted by the guy to my right, Jonah Lanto, and myself, Don Palumbo, and it is produced by the Good Talk Network. Be sure to name the episode. There, of course, are the QR codes all around. You may trip over one, frankly. There are so many out there. So definitely throw us your questions, throw us your title suggestions, all of it.
Yeah, let's get into the Q&A. Thank you so much, Bismarck. We appreciate you guys so much.
Not me.